In the spring of 2018, I had the great fortune of having as a guest on Unreal Bluegrass Don McLean. You may immediately recognize him as the American Pie author. So many great songs from Don. Don had a brand new album that came out that year, and came on to talk about his new album, Botanical Gardens. Don is also a big fan and very immersed into the bluegrass and banjo world. At the end of that visit, off the air, he said, "If you want to talk about banjos and bluegrass again, call me." I did that. The second hour, a new program with Don McLean. It's all focused on bluegrass. It's amazing what he lived through, all the knowledge that he picked up, his devotion to bluegrass music and banjos and guitars. Don McLean talking nothing but banjos and bluegrass. You're going to enjoy it. My great pleasure to introduce to the second time to Unreal Bluegrass, Don McLean. How are you, Don?
I'm very fine, thank you. And I always like talking about bluegrass and banjos and whatever, because I'm a big, you know, bluegrass fan. But that particular song, Over the Mountains, is an Uncle Dave Macon song. And he was, of course, the premier star of the Grand Ole Opry in the 1920s and early 30s, and played the banjo. And it was an incredible folklorist, you know, without even realizing he was. He had more great songs in his head than almost anybody that ever lived. And he was a tremendous instrumentalist and a, you know, real kind of like a vaudeville stage performer. He was in his late 70s by the time he became really successful. And his son Doris would play guitar and take him and go everywhere with him. So that album, Playing Favorites, I decided that, you know, there was so much pressure on me to be a songwriter, which I was. I put out three albums, Tapestry, American Pie, and Don McLean. And I just love to sing other people's music, you know, and always have. So I just started, I just had to make an album of some songs that I liked. And so there was quite a mixture on this record. There were songs like Every Day, which actually got on the charts in the UK, and another song that became number one in Ireland called The Mountains of Mourne.
Beautiful song.
And then there were a couple of Dave Macon songs, and there was an instrumental, a banjo mandolin instrumental, because on this record I had put together a little kind of an odd little group. The bass player was a guy named Rob Stoner, who had been on two of the three albums that I had made previously, American Pie and Don McLean. So he was fundamentally a rock and roll bass player, but we were buddies, and so he would sing harmony parts. And Frank Wakefield is a legend in bluegrass music, who I came in touch with through Lena Spencer, who ran the Cafe Lena in upstate New York. One of the many things that she did was to help various artists who were basically just getting by, you know, by their fingernails. And Frank was one of those. He lived in a trailer with his kids and scraping by with music, but he was a kind of genius. He would make symphonies on his mandolin. And he would actually work with the symphony orchestra in Saratoga. And it was amazing. And so I got to know him. And then a couple of other folks that were around who played sort of traditional fiddle. And there were a group of musicians that ended up being in the movie that Ken Burns did about the Civil War. They were the ones playing the music in the background. So their particular style of playing was very traditional. So anyway, I put this group together and we went in the studio and actually did a couple of gigs, which didn't work out so well, bluegrass gigs, because we really weren't very tight, but we were having fun. And, you know, we did this group of songs, 10, 12 songs, and somehow it all seemed to work. And, you know, even Rolling Stone liked it, and they used to hate everything I did.
I don't remember that, but you would. I don't remember that.
Well, that hurts, I'm telling you.
Oh, listen. And Frank Wakefield, did you know him? Here's the one of the – he's tremendous. You know, the one of the greatest mandolin players ever, and Bill Monroe even said that.
Does anybody know Frank Wakefield? I don't think
so. Yeah, I think so. I think
he's in his own. He's in his own little world.
Well, did you know him when he started like talking backwards and asking?
Yeah, he's way out there.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
He took his mandolin, you know, and it was red. And I said, "How'd you do that?" He says, "Well, I painted it and then I baked it." He baked it. Well, it's great sounding mandolin. I don't know if you can hear these song, "Happy Trails."
Yes.
Which we did on there. Yeah. He plays some nice mandolin, and, you know, we had a ball doing that. You know, we really did. There were also some other musicians on there as well. Chuck Lovell, who now plays with the Rolling Stones, who played piano on that record.
Wow. And it's a great record. It's a great record, Don. I mean, there's
and another very famous bass player. I can't think of his name. I had a number of bass players that I used. I used to have a great upright bass player named Russ Savakas, who was on there. He got killed, unfortunately, crossing the street in New York City. It's a terrible loss because he was a swinging upright bass player, and they were really hard to find. And he's a great guy.
Don, the last time we talked for Unreal Bluegrass was as your last studio album. Botanical Garden was coming out, and we talked, and during that conversation we discovered and kind of talked a little bit about your banjo playing and your bluegrass love, and I'm always surprised that this playing favorites was 2 years after American Pie. So you were talking about the fact that, you know, there was a lot of pressure to write new songs, but you wanted to sing these other great songs. We've talked about a few.
Well, there was banjo on American Pie too. I did Babylon.
That's right. That's right.
The banjo. And that's one of the most famous songs on the record in some quarters. So I worked out the banjo part and played the thing and then did the three parts against myself. But, you know, I gave up on the banjo on stage for the most part. Occasionally I do, but I don't practice enough, so I'm no good anymore like I once was. And so it's no good to play if you don't really play as well as you can. But I gave up because I could never come close to the banjo, to the two different banjo styles which defined the banjo for me. One was Pete Seeger's style banjo, and the other was Earl Scruggs. Earl Scruggs, basically, everybody that plays Scruggs style banjo basically copies Earl Scruggs. He worked out all these breakdowns, Randy Lynn Rag and, you know, Flint Hill Special. And they're worked out, and they're exactly the same. If you see the TV shows, which, thank God, are now available, you can see them on YouTube.
The Martha White shows he's talking about.
You can see the greatest, one of the greatest bands in the world that ever was, and that includes the Beatles or anybody else. As a musical aggregation, Latin Scruggs were absolutely royalty, and they were... you know, Lester Flatt is one of my favorite singers, and those guys never made mistakes. I mean, it was amazing. Earl would make mistakes once in a while. He was the star instrumentalist, but the rest of them were letter perfect always. And Lester was just a wonderful, wonderful artist, a songwriter, singer, country music character. I mean, he's as country as a dirt road, you know, and never tried to be anything but that, you know. And and then, of course, the vocal blend was out of this world.
I don't think that will ever be reproduced.
Reproduced. And then, you know, a lot of great bands, you know, the Carters and Stanley Brothers, of course, Bill Monroe and all those people. There are many other people. I can't think of the Osbournes, the the McReynolds or Jim and Jesse, you know, and a whole bunch of them, but they just, nobody can do what those guys did. And I learned a lot about them, too. Paul Warren, the fiddle player, who is absolutely magnificent, he spent 29 months in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. So these guys paid their dues to America. A bunch of them were in the army, you know. And
I'd never heard that about him.
Yeah, you know, I got into their lives. I wanted to know about them. Lester was, in the textile mill business there back in Sparta, where he came from. And he didn't feel like doing that for the rest of his life, so he was constantly trying to get employment. And then he locked on to Bill Monroe and then discovered Scruggs. And, then they had a great group from that point on. They changed a couple of people, but they always had Curly Seckler in there, too, who was a not really an original bluegrass boy, but he was might as well have been because he was there even after Scruggs left. You know, Curly Seckler held the band together when Lester was quite ill near the end of his life.
And a great singer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. And then Hilo Brown was in there a bunch, too. So I saw them, actually, once at Carnegie Hall. They played twice at Carnegie Hall. Once was the first time where they made the album, that famous album.
Right.
And the cover of that album was done by a friend of mine named Tom Allen. And Thomas B. Allen is the hero of Marty Stewart's, who has collected a lot of his paintings and covers and put together magnificent books about Tom Allen and has a lot of Tom's work in his big exhibit that he's going to have in Mississippi. But the second year, they came to Carnegie Hall with the banjo player, you know, the tall boots and the mustache, you know, to get out. Oh, what's his name?
Okay. We'll figure it out. Not Grandpa.
Grandpa Joe.
Okay, all right.
Grandpa Joe. A lot of the Flatten Scruggs records were done by Tom Allen, and he lived in upstate New York and was involved with the Hudson River Sloop, so I got to actually know him and become a friend of his. So it all kind of connected up, you know. It was funny. I drifted into this because I always wanted to know the Weavers, and I started calling them when I was a teenager. I was about 15. My father had died, and I just loved their music, so I called them. One of them, a man named Fred Hellerman, I got to know all of them, and then started doing work, you know, around in the 60s while I was going to college. And when I got out of college, I had gotten to know Pete Seeger, and I found my way up to the Hudson Valley and worked with him. I didn't work with him, it was a joy. Played with him on his shows and got involved with the building of his boat, and I was one of the performers that would often be on these shows that he would have to bring people down to the river so they could see the boat and so on. I was involved in the whole thing from before the boat was even launched, right up through into the 70s when it was going really good. So, you know, I was around a lot of musicians, and I was right in the middle of everything that I loved. It was quite a wonderful time for me.
To the listeners, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Don McLean. Now, you may think that you were listening to a bluegrass historian and not recognize that it's Don McLean, but you did live all that, Don, and your knowledge of that whole time from the folk scene into the bluegrass and all the people
Correct.
That you knew in New York in that area is just you have so much depth of understanding and appreciation.
Yeah, I knew them all, and I spent a lot of time with them all. Like, I'm probably one of the last people around who can play the banjo as Pete Seeger did. I know exactly how he did almost everything that he did. Because he was a brilliant musician, so he could make something up, you know, overnight that I never saw before. But I saw him do many, many things. So his banjo style was a grab bag of all sorts of different strums and things that he did. It was an odds and ends type of a thing, which he would seamlessly put together in his show, depending on how he wanted to use the instrument. It could be a lead instrument, it could be just a little background, it could be hardly anything, it could be a big sound. Scruggs I got around quite a bit also, and saw him up close and how he played. And you can see that on those shows, of course. And a whole different banjo, of course. It was a flathead Gibson, which was old. And the funny thing was, I'm going to tell your listeners a funny thing that is similar with both these banjo players. They both had a unique instrument that they used all the time. And Earl's banjo was this RB4 or whatever it was, a flathead Gibson, and it had a Hearts and Flowers on the fingerboard, and he had rejiggered it so that he could have those detuning pegs.
Yeah, he put those on the... He invented that. Yeah.
He invented that. And what it was a capstan and a little thing that went out, which is a screw that went out, and you could make the screw go out farther or less far, and it would be able to actually keep the thing in tune. You could tune the D that it would go to and then back up again. So it was flexible on both sides. Those middle two strings could be in perfect tune. Later on, a guy named Bill Keith invented an all-enclosed tuner that didn't have to put two holes through the peg head, and they were called Keith Scruggs pegs. And they had cams that you would adjust with
two little screws for where you would go swing down and swing back up to.
They were kind of handy.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Earl needed to do something on his banjo, so he sent the banjo to Gibson. And Gibson, I think he needed it refretted. So he sent the banjo to Gibson, and it came back with a different fingerboard. A fingerboard that had just those bow tie inlays on it. Very boring. They had taken this fingerboard off and put another one on that had these dumb bow ties on there and taken the Hearts and Flowers fingerboard off. He still almost wanted to cry when he would talk about what they did to him. Seeger, on the other hand, had a similar story. He made his own banjo neck because Pete used to like to make stuff. He made his banjo neck out of a wood called lignum vitae, which is heavier than ebony. It sinks. Mm. It's African. So there was no need for a fingerboard on this because it was fingerboard wood. It was that dense, you know?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
He created the neck and put the frets in. Well, the frets were slightly out of position, so he sent them to D'Angelico in New York. D'Angelico then planed the neck down and put a fingerboard on it.
Oh, on top.
And he was absolutely fit to be tied telling me that story.
Well, you know how it is.
And these two people, those two instruments were as important to them as Lead Belly's 12-string guitar, his Stella, or Bill Monroe's Gibson mandolin.
Yep, you're right. And you being a musician, you know how
that
is.
They mess with them, you know.
Yeah, I had it just the way I wanted it, and I sent it to you for something, and you changed it. I can't imagine, especially Earl was, they always said that Earl could play your banjo and make it sound like his. Because and it winds up so much was in his playing style and his right hand and his technique that he made things sound great. Don, another thing, we found out about your banjo love when we talked about the Botanical Gardens album. But I also wanted to talk to you today because I think just yesterday you signed with Time
Life.
Yeah, let's that's brand new.
Yeah.
So what albums are going to be released? What's going to be, how's that going
to
work out?
Well, my son said to me, you know, Dad, he said, you only have about 6 albums on Spotify, and you've probably made about 25 or 30 albums. And so what I did was we signed a deal with Time Life and Warner Brothers, and they are going to put out the remaining albums, probably another 15 albums or more. And they're all going to be available on every streaming platform. So there won't be a single track live or in the studio that I've ever recorded you won't be able to find someplace.
Really?
And they're also going to release digitally still playing favorites, which is a takeoff on the Playing Favorites album from 1973. Because I did another one of those albums of songs that I kind of like, you know, and they're in the gospel country, you know, style.
Is Playing Favorites going to be part of this release, the original Playing Favorites?
That's probably out there.
Okay.
Because Universal Songs owns the 6 records that I made for United Artists.
Okay. Well, so that was a big deal. That just happened yesterday, according to the press releases.
It's a big deal for me.
Yeah, it's great.
Because it's the record store in the sky now. You know, there's no other place to get anything. CDs don't really matter.
No.
There's no stores, you know, where you can buy.
We talked about that a little bit, Don, when your last album came out, that it was getting harder and harder to pick up physical copies of anything. You might as well get it in the sky. Like you say, the record store in the sky, you might as well do
it. That's where we are now. Everything is in the sky.
Yeah. Listen, I know you have a website. You're still very actively performing, right?
Yes.
And if people went to find you on your website, they would find out where you're going to be. I want to make sure people know how to do that.
You can Google me, go to the website. Mm-hmm. You can look up Don McLean tour dates. There's lots of ways you can find out things that I'm doing. I'm all over the place.
From this Playing Favorites, and I'm only picking on it because I wanted to come back and talk to you about some of the bluegrass, which you clearly know and lived and had all that experience in New York, but I'd like to take a second for the listeners and play from that album, Sitting on Top of the World, if I can do that, and then we'll come right back, we'll chat a little bit more, and I'll let you go.
Sure.
There, you just heard Sitting on Top of the World. That was from Don McLean's album entitled Playing Favorites, released in 1973. And you know what? You did that straight down the line, bluegrass. I mean, that song is you could find that anywhere and think that was bluegrass, whether they knew it was you or not.
Oh, and later on, there was an album that United Artists put out on, I guess it was EMI, because by that time they'd bought United Artists, called Favorites and Rarities. And one whole disc was stuff that I hadn't heard in 30 years that I had released that never got on any records. And there's the Hit Parade of Love on there, that Jimmy Martin song.
Yeah.
We were going to put on Playing Favorites, but we never did. It was neat.
Did you ever perform it?
I might have performed it that couple of times. I did that Bluegrass Festival. I remember we were down there with the famous, the original Country Gentleman. And... You know, we went on and did what we were doing, which is a sloppy mess.
Well, the Country Gentlemen were pretty precise.
You know, those guys are perfect.
You also do a great, I'm talking to Don McLean if you're just tuned in on Real Bluegrass. And Don, thanks so much for your time. We're just kind of catching up on old things and new things, what you're doing and the Time Life deal. But also on that Playing Favorites is you do a absolutely full-bore version of New Mule Skinner Blues.
Yeah, that's right, sure. I'm an old Mule Skinner. See, he can drive the heck out of a group, Frank Wakefield, with that mandolin. It's amazing.
It's a no holds barred. The only way I can describe it. I'm going to play that throughout the show at some point.
Cool.
I'll let people hear that one for you. Don McLean, listen, thanks so much for coming back to Unreal Bluegrass. It's always a pleasure. I'm always amazed at the knowledge of bluegrass and all that good old music that you know. And I'm always welcome, and you're always welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I like bluegrass. I like the folk music that it comes from. I like the musical instruments, you know, the mandolins, the guitars, the banjos, the fiddles. I'm way into my guitars, you know, my Martin guitars. I've got probably 40 or 50 of them.
Wow.
And, God, they're just, they were the most beautiful thing I ever saw when I was 15 years old, and here I am, 74, and they still are.
You made a comment last time we talked, Don, and I'll let you go, but we talked about acquiring instruments and that you acquired some, and you made it sound like it was a rescue project for banjos and guitars.
Yeah, sometimes it is. You know, I'll see a great guitar, say, man, I got to get that. The price is okay, and someone's going to get this and completely screw it up. So I'll have it, you know.
All right.
And so they're nice and safe, and I've got some amazing ones. You know, I take them out every night. I like those early 50s D28s, 53, 54, and right up through 57. And they change the tuners, but man, those, you can't get a better acoustic guitar than a D28 in good condition, and they're bad. They're out there, you know, from those years. I mean, they sound every bit as good as the ones they want, you know, $300,000 for, you know, from the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. And Don, I think you put them to great use. In the last interview, we talked about a lot of your music around the bluegrass. But listen, I'm just a fan, and we spent a lot of time talking about American Pie last time. I'm not doing that this time because I don't need to. We've done it. But everybody knows that song and that the effect it had, and I'm so appreciative of your time being on the show on short notice. I know I kind of caught you by surprise.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. I'll let you go, Don McLean. Thanks so much, man.
We'll talk again someday.
See you. Bye.
Bye.